Hello, everyone, and welcome to yet another of our Private Wealth Management exclusive call series with our special guest, Neil Malik. I'm John Matthews, the head of Private Wealth Management at UBS here in the United States. And again, thanks for joining us. I'm excited to be joined by Neil today, Neil Malik. Neil is the founder and CEO of K1 Investment Management, one of the largest investors in the small cap enterprise software companies. Previously, he founded the growth equity practice at Kayne Anderson and has an incredible experience in this space. Neil, I'm excited to talk to you about your career at K1 and your views on the enterprise software space. So welcome. Thanks for joining us today.
John, pleasure's all mine. Thank you so much for having me here today.
Yeah. Neil and I have spent some time together, and I just feel that the space that Neil's in is very important for our investors today. So, Neil, let's just talk about your background and the inception of K1.
Sure. Yeah. So originally an East Coast kid, grew up just west of New York City, where we sit right now. Studied engineering and business at Wharton undergrad and then in the engineering school there at Penn. Started my career here in New York on Wall Street, actually 60 Wall Street to be specific, mm-hmm. at JP Morgan doing mergers and acquisitions. And after a few years, decided I really wanted to get into the buy side, get into helping to build companies and be part of that longer-term journey beyond the transactional elements, of course, of mergers and acquisitions.
Right.
So I learned a lot, but then really wanted to apply that as a principle. And so that really led me into this industry called private equity. Literally 30 years ago, almost to the day, 1995. Very much a cottage industry.
Kind of early, yeah. Right.
Very early. Yeah. There was barely a trade rag covering the space. Probably less than really 100 notable firms across the country. And very, very early days, as you said. So a really exciting time to be part of, the early stages of what today is, I think, an amazing force in our economy.
Yeah. And how did you form K1?
Yeah, so really K1's the product of a lot of the experiences that I had leading up to that moment 15 years ago back in 2010.
Mm-hmm.
When I left banking and learned the skills and the trades of Wall Street, applying that to investing, there was still a lot left to be learned. And so in the first firm that I joined just up the street here in Stamford, Connecticut, the best deals we found didn't actually come to us. We had to go find them. And so being very outbound oriented and this notion of directly sourcing deal flow. So literally I would get on the phone in the morning and target high growth companies in a variety of sectors looking for entrepreneurs that we might be able to partner with. There was a wonderful company that I identified in 1995. They had just raised $5 million of capital from a VC called Kleiner Perkins, and the CEO was very gracious in sharing that he was well-funded at that moment. But you never know the next time you're going to call on and have a conversation with the next Jeff Bezos.
Yeah.
And that's something that's really exciting for our team today. We have 25 people that are directly sourcing and talking to founders and entrepreneurs that are really initiating the change and the innovation that we're all talking about.
Yeah. Why I find what you do so interesting and timely is that all we hear about today is the Mag 7, Microsoft, NVIDIA. I mean, we only hear the big ones. But there's so much opportunity, and I think there's so much investors are missing mm-hmm. with all of the other smaller private software enterprise companies that are creating some exciting stuff. So maybe talk about that dichotomy of what we hear about on TV every day and compared to what you're actually doing and who you're looking for.
Yeah. Well, first of all, many of the Mag 7, as you call them, they often have a consumer-facing brand. And as a result, a lot of people can identify with the product or the service. So that certainly captures a lot of attention. We see that in the B2C or business-to-consumer space quite a bit. There's a lot of, we call it riches in the niches. We think there's a lot of great investing happening with businesses that are much less well-known.
Yeah.
And candidly, we think it's a lot easier to turn a dollar into $5 than $5 billion into $25 billion. And so the opportunities to make a multiple of one's money or to generate a very high rate of return, it gets really, really hard as these companies get more and more valuable. Of course, that's when the press really starts to cover them, and that's when it occupies a lot of our mind share, and we start to get really, really concentrated in those very names. So there's this forgotten 470,
right,
if you
yeah.
will, yeah. And at least they're giving homage to the top 30 companies that mm-hmm. are half the market cap now. I mean, clearly a remarkable time if you're in the liquid markets to see that much concentration. We think that the next leaders of innovation are going to come from that longer tail. There's also, by the way, a Russell 2000 index out there of really amazing companies. And today, private equity has really grown. A significant part of the economy is now funded by and supported by venture capital and private equity. So this whole other part of the economy that says, maybe we're not going to go public. You know, maybe the IPO is not the ultimate dream, but there's a tremendous amount of capital appreciation that's occurring in the private market. So we're seeing a lot of next generation leading companies stay private either indefinitely or certainly much, much longer than ever before. And we believe that's where innovation really occurs.
Right. Yeah.
Innovation really occurs when founders have limited resources and limited time and existential risk, and necessity is the mother of invention. And that's where we see breakthroughs. We generally aren't going to see breakthroughs in 9-to-5 businesses. There've been a lot of research that shows that when companies go public, the number of patents, the level of innovation, it starts to tail off. And so as we think about technology and innovation and productivity really driving our model of capitalism, that is occurring in a lot of other parts of the economy outside of just the Mag 7. And to stay at the top of the hill, well, that's really tough. If you look right. at the top market cap companies in the public market in 2000 versus today, you would see a very different list of companies. And I venture to say in the next 20 years or even less time, you're going to see another major rotation. And so it's really important to, I think, diversification, I'm sure, is something that is espoused by you and the team here, and this is a time when it's really coming to the fore that being diversified is a very, very prudent strategy.
Yeah, and yet all we hear about are those big name companies that you talk about. But I know what excites you and gets your team up every morning is that going after and finding those innovators, those entrepreneurs, those smaller businesses. But with that comes with a lot of risk too, right? So maybe talk about some lessons learned at K1 about how to make sure you properly risk manage as much as you can when looking and identifying those right companies.
Yeah, so I think one of the great aspects of investing in technology and the kinds of business-to-business technologies that make up our portfolio, we are looking for the most predictable and repeatable business models and revenue streams we can find, mm-hmm. Which takes us to this concept of subscription revenue.
Yeah.
This dates back to the media companies and magazines. Or utilities and water and electric companies. Companies that have subscription revenue begin the year knowing a tremendous amount of their future forecast and budget. Our companies have 90%+ of their revenues are contractual into the coming year. So through the GFC, through the pandemic, we see these enterprise software companies selling to other businesses productivity solutions that continue to grow during these really difficult, trying times. Mm-hmm. So if you have an accounting platform, if you have a customer relationship management or CRM system or an employee database, those are things that process payroll, that generate sales leads, that handle all of your debits and credits. These are systems that operate in the background. They're not very sexy to write about
right.
on the cover of magazines and newspapers, but they have tremendous amount of visibility and predictability, which we think leads to credit quality. And so as a result, when it comes time to underwriting these businesses, client diversification, having lots of different customers, growth rate clearly, but then also what level of retention, how many of their customers stick with the product year over year. And if you've got over 90% of your revenues a subscription, and if you have 90% of your clients coming back and then buying another 10, 15% more every year, you've got a pretty amazing business model that I have a hard time designing something better with a clean sheet of paper compared to just about any other industry that I've seen and been a part of or looked at investing in.
Yeah, maybe like fixing the legacy technology platforms that big institutional type firms like the big banks out there. I mean, you're finding ways to get in and helping those companies with this new enterprise software.
That's right, and it's still very early days. I mean, a lot of the systems, right or wrong, are quite old. Mm-hmm. The major banks here in New York are still running systems that were designed and built and implemented decades and decades ago. Right. Now, there is this digitizing wave that's occurring, and more of the applications are moving to the cloud. I know another one of your major competitors in the space has made some very substantial moves towards getting more and more of their applications into the cloud and next-generation cloud applications. This takes a lot of time and a tremendous amount of effort on the part of the staff to migrate these legacy systems, which, again, just demonstrates how sticky they are and how predictable they are. And even though we invest in small companies, they have these attributes that I think makes them far less volatile than a lot of industries that have more beta. So here we are in early April. We're looking at travel and tourism numbers coming in for the summer and a lot of concern around what's this year's tourist level of interest going to be. And the companies that we know are going to get hit first are going to be the airlines, it's going to be the hotels, and it's going to be the restaurants. These are industries that have higher beta in the overall stock market.
Right.
Utilities have the lowest beta and generally aren't that exciting from a return perspective. What we have here in this sector is remarkable because we have low beta, like a utility, and yet we have opportunities for outperformance. So this thing called a Sharpe ratio, I think it's just off the charts. It's been that way for decades. It's a real hidden gem in, I think, the overall market. And I think if people want to be part of consistently making money, this is a great place to be. It's not great to show up at the country club to talk about a deal that no one's heard of.
Right.
But the returns are really nice.
Right. Yeah. Well, I think it's interesting. You're talking about cash flow.
Yeah.
Right. And so often we think about technology companies are the ones you're going to make the big hit in. And you're talking about good old-fashioned cash flow and predictable earnings, which I think is lost sometimes in how people think about small mid-cap technology stocks. But as you think about how you've been successful up to this point, what are some trends that you're seeing in the enterprise software field over the next 5 to 10 years? As you said, there's going to be another transition. What do you see the transition in the space?
Yeah, so we still see a significant amount of time and effort needed by major Fortune 500 companies to completely transform and digitize into the cloud exclusively. We also see a tremendous amount of innovation, as always, occurring at the younger entrants, the younger companies with the newer technologies. The category leaders today that we talk about in software, in many cases, were built 20, 30, 40 years ago in some cases.
Yeah.
And they built amazing businesses. The next generation of innovation might be 5 or 10 years old. And applying these next generation capabilities to build the next category leader is what we really get excited about backing. And there's no question that where we sit today is an inflection point with the ability to implement things like machine learning and things like artificial intelligence. It's now become much more in the public domain that these technologies are ripe, these technologies are available to be used by even lay people with no code applications, and do things to drive further productivity for individuals and organizations that we've never seen before. And I think it's going to be these younger, next-generation, soon-to-be category leaders that are going to really adopt and drive this change. And it's hard when you're really successful and really big to turn that big ship, that big tanker, and it's going to be these younger companies that can really adopt and drive that innovation ever faster.
Yeah, and artificial intelligence is real. I mean, we're going to come back to that towards the end, but it's not a dream anymore. It's real, and we'll get into that. But this year, and you and I have talked about it, this has been a year of volatility. Yeah. And it can come in many different forms. It can come from a tweet. It can come from tariffs. It can come from, you know, geopolitical events. You name it, we've had it.
Yeah.
But how do you guys operate in a world of volatility? And how do you see the risk and opportunities with this volatility that we're all seeing in the markets today?
Yeah, so look, 30 years in private equity, we've seen lots of volatility. We've seen the dot-com bubble. We've seen the global financial crisis back in 2008. We've seen the pandemic just a handful of years ago. That said, the level and the pace of volatility feels like the wheel is spinning faster and faster on us today. And so trying to be cognizant of all the forces that can impact us, I think, is a challenge for everybody out there today. From our standpoint, we feel really lucky. We are not dealing with an industry that has a tangible product. We sell an intangible product. It's code services that are in the cloud. So we don't have critical componentry or raw materials. We don't have to deal with supply chains and inventory, and we certainly don't need to, at this stage, have to worry about what is the tariff on a landed good at customs today. So we feel very fortunate to be, I think, outside of the bullseye of where a lot of the policymakers are spending their time on more tangible products that are shipped across borders.
Right.
So from that standpoint, when GDP shrank in 2020, you would still see a lot of these B2B software companies growing. And we think that even if GDP starts to suffer this year, and I think the forecast is are now coming around to less growth, maybe more inflation, our companies are still going to perform, and this sector, I think, is going to still perform incredibly well. It's demonstrated its resilience, during COVID. So we think this sector has maybe a bit of an inoculation from some of the geopolitics that are occurring at this very moment.
Yeah, and because by nature of what you do, you're a private equity investor, private equity manager, you're buying private companies. And so you're not dealing with the day-to-day fluctuations of, let's say, a liquid stock market, though there are fluctuations in valuations. And so with that said, how do you feel about this timing for exits in your space from the private company either going public or selling to another company? How do you feel that, the prospects of, very positive exits with the macroeconomic backdrop?
Yeah, so historically, some of the most exciting exits occur in this form of an IPO. Mm-hmm. That has been an incredibly challenged place to be. I mean, we all know that over the last several decades, the number of public companies has shrunk in half.
Which is amazing, by the way.
Yeah.
And especially in your field. I mean, they've seemed like so many of them have chosen just to stay private longer.
Yeah, and a number of them have gone private after having been public as well. And so the outlook for liquidity is quite challenged at the very large end of the market. If you're buying large companies, in many cases, the takeout is going to be an IPO. That's the investment thesis. I think some of that might also be true with some of the most high-profile venture capital deals out there as well. It actually creates a buying opportunity because there's the forgotten 470. There's also, like I said, the Russell 2000. So there are a lot of businesses that are literally trading for a fraction of the price that they were, and I mean a small fraction of the price they were trading for just a few years ago. And so the opportunities for take privates is actually pretty exciting. But on the liquidity front, over the last 25 years, the single worst year, I think, was 2009 for LPs getting money back from private equity. I think the second worst year in the last quarter century was 2023. 2024 has gotten a little bit better. I was just reading this morning's newspaper. M&A volumes are ticking up a little bit around the world. They're actually down a little bit in the U.S., which is unusual.
Right.
And then the mid-market seems to have a lot more resilience than the very largest of deals and the mega deals that people were really looking for a resurgence in 2025. From our standpoint, because we're investing in some of the smallest, most innovative companies in our space, the opportunities to exit those to larger funds, to their portfolio companies, and to listed acquirers, public companies that are buying our businesses, is quite exciting. And so for us, 2024 actually was an all-time record year, and we saw a number of our businesses get acquired by the Fortune 500. They're acquisitive. Their ability to pay, if they're truly strategic acquisitions, is much higher than a financial buyer. And this is an area that we're going to continue to focus on and build those relationships. And, our view is that 2025, at our end of the market and for our firm, will be likely another all-time record high on top of even 2024.
Really? Maybe let's bring it to life with a real-life example of maybe a company you acquired, what you did to help them increase their profile or maybe their profitability, and maybe the exit.
Yeah. So a little over a decade ago, we bought a business that helps organizations regulated by the SEC, banks and insurance companies, remain compliant. So We help those banks capture, archive, and now increasingly surveil all the electronic communications inside of 8 of the top 10 banks in the world outside of China, for example. This is a business that has scaled from less than $40 million in revenue to now over 10 times that, at over $500 million in revenue this year. A business that was break even when we acquired it and is now generating over $200 million in earnings. It's been a phenomenal run for us. It's one of our largest companies. And over that period of time, we helped them with strategic technology acquisitions. We bought a business that was steeped in AI and algorithms back in 2021 called Digital Reasoning. We helped them with building out the leadership team with world-class CTO, CFO, CEO. And at every step of the way, it's important for us to recognize that we have to put the best executives, you know, on that team every weekend, if you will, at the game. And so we have 12 executive recruiters that spend all of their time helping our management teams find those key players at key moments in the game to level up our abilities to grow that business mm-hmm. and double and triple it year after year. And so today, we believe our business is the category leader in the space, the capabilities that we bring and the customer base that we enjoy. And again, this is a business that sells a product that banks and insurance companies and broker-dealers and RIAs have to own. And we are now helping those organizations become more efficient at it. So there are literally rooms full of people reading our electronic communications, making sure that nothing nefarious is happening. Mm-hmm. Now with agentic AI, we can have 70% in some of our pilot cases of that human surveillance cost completely eliminated. In fact, these agentic models are so powerful, you know, they don't sleep, they don't take coffee breaks, they remember everything, and their capabilities are so strong, we believe they'll actually be better at this job than humans. And it's very exciting because now banks can look at this as ways to maybe drive revenue, not just be compliant. Hey, if we just sold this great new client a great one of our products or services, what did that sales team do to win that piece of business? What can we learn from those communications, and how can we apply that in our next deal?
Right.
So these are systems that can absorb remarkable amounts of data, interpret it, analyze it, and then provide us with insights. Both from a revenue perspective and from a compliance perspective.
Yeah, great story of how you just broaden the profile and then the value, overall enterprise value of the company, and it's still in the portfolio. So, you know, it's incredible. Yeah. And you talked a lot about AI, artificial intelligence. It's, you know, the hot word or the hot phrase everyone's talking about. So like ChatGPT, Grok, DeepSeek, Copilot, there's so many of them today. It's like we see a new AI tool hitting the market. How do you feel about AI in the future?
Sure.
Right? You mentioned something earlier about sometimes they remember more, they're more productive. It makes me think of the show on HBO called Westworld, where they're actually robots that actually are identical to people.
Yeah.
Where are we going to end up in this whole AI space? What's the Neil Malik view of AI as we look in the next 10 years, let's say, going forward?
Well, the first thing I would recommend for those that might be cynical or hard to envision what that future might look like, there's an article written in 1995 by a Newsweek journalist called Why the Internet Will Fail.
Yeah.
And if you read that article today, just about everything that was predicted that they were cynical about has actually happened.
Yeah.
But the author was very right about the human connection element and the risk of losing that. Look, with AI today, the possibilities are really remarkable. We believe that data is actually the new oil. We believe that algorithms will continue to commoditize. Algorithms, you know, a new PhD student can publish a new algorithm, you know, every year. And so we're seeing DeepSeek and we're seeing other things that are driving the cost of compute much, much lower over time. In fact, there's even concern that large language models that have consumed the overall internet have begun to peak in their capabilities.
Mm.
So a lot of the focus has now shifted from large language models, or LLMs, to narrow or small language models. We built our business on investing in systems of record. These are the systems that contain all your data, your portfolio, all the things you've bought and sold over time. That's incredible data. And those are systems that wouldn't be switched out very quickly, which is what we loved about them when we underwrote them. But they, too, are small language models, just like all the electronic communications in a bank.
Right.
And so we can apply algorithms to that data that no one else has. That's the proprietary nature of the moat that we've built with the portfolios and the portfolios we look to build. And we think that we've now moved from the data with our applications to now a next generation of products and services with AI that put us, I think, in a very advantageous position relative to older, larger incumbents that are a little slower to move, and startups that might have great algorithms, but if you don't have the data, it gets very difficult in the business-to-business world to get a large organization like UBS to adopt a new great whiz-bang point solution.
Yeah.
So we've been actually very acquisitive in buying great next-generation technologies and then incorporating that into our existing companies, and then we can use that as a distribution channel that we've already built to upsell and cross-sell. And in those cases, our clients are very excited about the next-generation capabilities because there's trust,
yeah,
and we have their data,
right,
and we've been working with them for years.
Yeah. And like you said, it's just so much evolves around data, right? I love the comment, data is the new oil, because that's what drives all of these models going forward.
Yeah, I think that's the
It moment. May even drive that, you know, that robotic pet.
Yes.
So, you know, for a person, you know, so somebody can have, you know, some companionship without having to take the dog outside,
well,
right?
Yeah, to your Westworld comment, I mean, we are already seeing applications in the consumer space. We don't play here.
Yeah.
Where you can build a relationship, a companionship, at almost any level of the human experience. You know, we are seeing people use this in the medical space and for therapy.
Mm-hmm.
And there are safeguards that need to be put in place. And, you know, there's just a brave new world of opportunities out there. And it's a very exciting time. So I think not in 30 years, but in 5 or 10 years, we're going to look back on this moment and say, wow, we had no idea how much the world was about to change.
Unbelievable. Well, Neil, thanks so much for joining us today. It's been great learning about your funds. Been great to hear your views on, you know, the software enterprise space, as well as the kind of where we're going in the future with AI. And I'd like to thank all of our clients for tuning in with us today. If you want to learn more about what Neil Malik and K1 does, they have a number of funds in the market. Actually, number K6 is
That's
in
right.
the market today. Please reach out to your financial advisor to learn more. And thanks again for joining us, Neil. You're a great friend, and thank you for joining us. And I appreciate everybody joining us today. Have a great rest of your day.
Thank you, John. My pleasure.
As a firm providing wealth management services to clients, UBS Financial Services, Inc. offers investment advisory services in its capacity as an SEC-registered investment advisor and brokerage services in its capacity as an SEC-registered broker-dealer. Investment advisory services and brokerage services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. It is important that you understand the ways in which we conduct business and that you carefully read the agreements and disclosures that we provide to you about the products or services we offer. For more information, please review client relationship summary provided at ubs.com/relationship summary or ask your UBS financial advisor for a copy.